Welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick. Today we're doing our CISSP content. And specifically, we're going to continue our look at software development security. And in this episode, we want to take it to that next step, right? We've learned about the different software development models. We've talked about implementing security early and often. Adam's taught us a lot of things about how to make sure we're developing that software security. We've talked about malware as well. Now we want to take a look at the effectiveness of software security. And here to help us with that is Mr. Adam Gordon. How's it going, Adam?
Good. So, you know, let's talk a bit about assessment, effectiveness, software security, all things that Mike just kind of introduced his thought processes for us. When we are thinking about how to decide, right, whether or not something is working, we have to have a couple of things. We have to have a baseline for what we assume would logically equal success. We have to have a way to measure where we are currently at the present moment, where we would like to go and the process to get us from point A to point B. And we have to then understand unequivocally and through a relatively straightforward process what the definition or the bar for success will equal. And when we think about assessment, we have to think about all these things. And so when we think about assessing software security, we have to understand what the current state of security is. We have to define what security may be or what it will not be. We have to then understand whether or not we meet that definition currently. If we do, we have to figure out how to quantify and measure that. If we don't, we have to figure out where the gaps are. And then we have to decide what success will look like. It could look like what we do today. It may look like something very different. It may look like a combination of the two things. And then based on understanding those things, we then have to define, document, and declare what our as-is, what our progression from as-is into the to be looks like, what to be equals, our desired state, what success equals, and then we have to come up with a plan to measure that, not only in the current state, in the present moment, but continuously to assess compliance ongoing, and then understand from a baseline perspective, if we do deviate, what our not only compliance issue will be, but also what our mitigation solution will be. How do we then impact that mitigation is used, or the concept of mitigation will be used to impact positively the changes we see to bring them back into alignment and effect? And how do we impact that change, that drift or delta, in such a way through gap analysis and ultimately through remediation that we can address whatever deviations we find and bring our system or systems back into compliance? This is the process we have to think about and go through ultimately. One of the most important things we can do along the way is understand, and we've talked a lot about this in prior conversations, understand, assess, and ultimately define what risk is and what risk equals within the organization. One of the great tools we have to think about doing that would be the risk management framework. NIST 800 or NIST SP800-37R1 is going to be the current version of the risk management framework, or at least the guidance around risk management framework. Risk management framework, one form or another, has been around for probably over a decade now. But the idea is that we want to be thinking about the thought processes associated with risk identification. Remember, you know, we talk about threat actors, we talk about threat, we talk about vulnerability, we talk about the availability to exploit that vulnerability, and then ultimately what all that equals or culminates in is the idea of identification of risk, management of risk, and the measurement of risk in relation to the business, the exposure factor, and the impact and the liability we have as a result of that. So the risk management framework comes to mind here, something we want to remind ourselves of, be aware of, think about. You know, with CISSPs, it's always very important to think about risk. So I'll share with you a little practical story that happened to me just earlier today that I was asking Mike about. He helped me to resolve the issue. And it really kind of just at a baseline level demonstrates the potentiality for risk and the exposure associated with risk or liability. So, you know, as many of us do, my car has a remote control option, a remote key entry option. And so I've used that remote probably several times a day for the last 3.5 years since I bought that car with no trouble. Got it from the dealer. Everything was fine. Click a button, boom, door opens. Click a button, boom, door closes. Occasionally click the wrong button, boom, alarm goes off. Don't want that to happen too often. But I'm first one to admit I'm one of those people that sets it off on occasion by accident. So I go to do that this morning, not set off the alarm. That was not what I wanted to do this morning, but to open and then ultimately close the door. And so I pull up here at the IT Pro TV studios, the palatial place that IT Pro TV and the studios are. And the valet driver was not here this morning, wasn't available to park my car for me. I've talked about that, by the way.
He took an extended vacation.
So I had to park my own car this morning when I pulled up here at IT Pro TV. And so I went ahead, parked the car, and went to lock it. And I went to use the remote, and remote's dead. It's not working. and I'm pressing, of course, you know, because you stand there, dumbstruck, right? It's like you pick up the phone, there's no dial tone. You're like, what? No dial tone. So I'm going like this, it's not working. Finally, being the intelligent, smart human being that I am, I eliminate the obvious because I bang it on my hand to make sure it's not, that the gremlins inside aren't awake and moving. We do the stupidest things sometimes. And so ultimately, I finally figured out through process of elimination, applying the scientific method, right, eliminate the obvious things, it must be the battery. It's not working. So I figure that out. I come inside. We do our shows and our episodes this morning, no problem. And I say at some point to Mike, hey, got to get a battery to replace the battery. It's in there. He says, oh, well, go down so-and-so, you know, go down this area. There's a place to get a battery. So I went and did all that, came back, took care of it. It's fine. And by the way, Valet Parker's still not outside. Just thought I'd mention that. Was not here when I came back from lunch either. So I had to park my own car again. Just saying, I'm talented here. I was expecting a little bit more. It's all. I'm suggesting nothing really big deal, but you might want to take a note. Just think about that for the next time. So I parked my own car, and it worked just fine. So that's not the risk part. The risk part was, hey, you know what? If the battery failed, did I have a spare battery with me? The answer is clearly no, or we wouldn't have a funny story to talk about with you. But because I didn't assess the risk, the likelihood of the battery failing, it's been working for over 3 years, no problem. What's the likelihood that thing's going to fail and randomly fail today? Well, obviously pretty good because it did. But did I assess that? Was I concerned about that? You know, in the grand scheme of things, not really, because I could have just used the key as I did this morning to lock the car with no trouble. However, as with all good things, I found out something new as a feature on my car I did not realize that my car did until this happened. So in all the years I've had the car, never had the battery on the remote fail. So when I failed this morning, you know, being, as I said, the idiot that I am, I'm sitting there trying to do this to press it. It's not working. So I go to open the door to see if the door is locked or not. And the thing starts, the thing with wheels, you know, the thing that you drive, you go down the road and moves. So the car starts beeping at me or pinging. You know, hey, the door is open light comes on the dash, but it normally never pings. You know that annoying, like, hey, your seatbelt's not on?
Ding,
same
ding,
kind of thing,
yep.
Ding, ding, ding. So it's doing that, and the light's flashing on the dash is one of the warnings. And so I close the door, and, you know, I lock it with the key, double check it, it's fine. And so I get in, and, you know, being the person that I am, I don't take, you know, the current status quo to be the status quo, and I don't take well enough as being good. So I go out today before I go to replace battery. I think, well, it's been 2 hours, right? It'll work. So I try it again. Doesn't work. The battery's totally dead. But I did that. Open the door. It's pinging at me again. This never happened in 3.5, almost 4 years I've owned the car. And so once I got the battery in and I got it fixed and I did that, I figured out that not just the light coming on. So the light comes on when you open the door, no trouble, but it doesn't ping. I figured out that's a feature. That's a warning sign that tells you the battery's dead on the remote.
Really?
Which I did not know.
That's
which,
good to know.
Had I read the owner's manual, it's only about this big. Had I read it, it would have told me that. I would have known, and it wouldn't have been a problem. So you see, the dealer had clearly dealt with, and the manufacturer, the risk, and had come up with a way to alert me to the risk that the battery was indeed not working, or the remote itself had stopped working. But I, being clueless and not being educated, hence the reason we often talk about training and awareness as being so critical for the CISSP, I did not pay attention. I was not educated. I did not take the opportunity to do that. I did not mitigate the risk successfully. The dealer did on my behalf. The manufacturer did. I was not aware. So in effect, they did the right thing. I screwed up. I did not do the right thing by paying attention. But ultimately, I learned something new and valuable. So in the now new life cycle of the car, if I ever live to have this car long enough that happens again, I'm prepared. I will know when the thing starts pinging, my remote is dead. So I do that. I'm going to go home and take the battery out, try to get my wife involved in this, see if she can figure this out and see how that goes when we get done. So, you know, the idea behind risk mitigation and risk awareness and risk management is obviously, clearly, if the impact is high, you know, I would have bothered to take the steps to figure out what was going on. The loss of the remote, not a big deal. I have a key. I can operate the car with or without it. It's a convenience issue, but it's not an operational safety issue. It's not a concern issue. Not like somebody's going to come along and steal the car, right? Because I could still lock it, at least not for that reason anyway. So the risk is relatively low. And when we think about risk and risk management, we have to classify risks, right? You know, high value risks, high impact, high exposure, high vulnerability are going to be risks that we really want to assess, deal with, and be concerned about. Low impact, low vulnerability, low concern risks are risks we want to be aware of. We want to take note of them. Like I did, I knew in theory in the back of my mind the battery could potentially fail, and indeed it did, but I really wasn't concerned about it, right? Because ultimately, you get it fixed. It's not a big deal. So risks are not all the same as the point of the story, right? Roundabout way to get there, but not all risks are equally impactful. not all risks are equally important, and not all risks should be taken seriously to the point that we have to worry about mitigating them and dealing with them and having a solution on hand. I should not, in other words, carry around a spare battery with me everywhere I go on the assumption that at some point the battery is going to fail. Because what would probably have happened is the spare battery would have failed over the 3 years that I kept it in the car. Because if you don't keep it in the car, it's not going to be available when you need it. If you're one of those people, right?
Yeah.
You have the battery. Oh, yeah, I'm good. And then you go to open it, the battery's dead along with the remote. Then you know, obviously are, unfortunately, you thought you were prepared, but you're not. So the reality is, you know, we have to assess risks. And what the risk management framework helps us to do is really understand how to not just assess risk once, but through a dynamic ongoing process, which is very important. Continuously assess risk and understand the impact of risk throughout the life cycle, the system, the service, whatever it is we may be assessing, and throughout the organization, across the entire organization holistically, what that impact is. So I want to be thinking about that. Obviously, keeping an eye on those things, continuing to be connected to them becomes very, very important. We have to audit and we have to log in order to assess risk, and we have to bring change management back into the equation to deal with risk. We've talked about these linkages before. Auditing and logging helps us to create a paper trail, effectively create a forensic solution that we can go back to and examine over time if necessary or if need be in order to figure out what was going on at a certain moment in time or perhaps through a series of events unravel something that did occur. So auditing and logging become very important as part of risk management. Want to be thinking about that. We know that logs are going to effectively be records of all the activities that are taking place inside of a system or throughout multiple systems, and we have different logs for different reasons. Want to have the ability to be able to monitor that centrally. Talk about the use of a SEM system, security information and event management, in order to be able to centrally aggregate logs, bring them together, do analysis on them, bring data visualization techniques to bear, things of that nature, centrally store and manage and archive logs for the express purpose of risk management. And so this kind of a thought process from a CISSP's perspective becomes important. You'll ask yourselves, as we're going through this with you, how well today, currently, in your job, in your world, outside of the environment we're talking about here, but in the real world, how well do you, how well does your company, how well does the organization you represent work for and or work through? How well do they do logging today? How well do they do auditing? How well do they manage change? How well do they manage configuration? How well do they assess and therefore ultimately understand and manage risk? You know, if these answers are not forthcoming quickly, if you're not able to say unequivocally, oh, yeah, we're very good at log management. We've got this, this, and this going on. We have a retention period clearly defined. We have a central management solution for logging. We have data classification applied to that. We have the ability to be able to not only classify our data, but to do deep packet, deep inspection analysis on logs and data streams. We can capture them in real time, archive them, and hold them for a period of time. We tie DLP, IRM, and e-discovery systems into our log management solution. We have policies as well as procedures, as well as processes, all detailed, reported on, communicated effectively up and down the organization, and we audit against that randomly to check validity and to check current state. If you're not able to talk through that solution and hit all the check boxes I just ranted through in 30 or 40 seconds and say yes to all of that, that's not a good or a bad thing. It just means that there's room for improvement, right? And the idea is ultimately, this is not about, hey, you guys suck and wow, these guys are doing so much better. It's about what are you doing today? How good is the current state? In other words, can we make it better? Chances are probably yes, but not always. And so if we can make it better, great. If we can't, okay, maybe it's as good as it's going to get. As a CISSP, we have to understand what the current state of affairs is, good, bad, or ugly. We have to be brutally honest about it, and we then have to figure out whether there is a path, a way forward, to make that better, either incrementally or over time, by changing out one or more aspects of the system. But we have to do so throughout the conversation with the business by showing and ultimately convincing the organization, the stakeholders, the customers, that risk exists, documenting it, clearly identifying it, and then coming up with a plan, a solution, a way forward, if you will, that is value positive, that creates value by changing and modifying and ultimately mitigating risk into something that could be managed. And this is really what CISSPs are supposed to do every day. Remember, due care and due diligence. We've talked a lot about this, talked about the importance, the focus, and the reasons why this is so critical. If you're not able to say yes to all the things we mentioned, then you've got some work cut out for you. Your business is going to have a need, even more so, probably than they did before our conversations, for guidance and for clear and articulate policy, procedure, and process to be implemented and managed in order to achieve the end result that you're looking for. This is the value you can add as a CISSP. This is ultimately why being a CISSP can be so tremendously impactful. to the organizations that you work with and represent. And if there isn't that opportunity, it could certainly be one that you create for yourself and by extension for the business by bringing those best practices to bear and then focusing the business on risk. And this is one of the key, most important aspects of what CISSPs are able to do. Remember auditing, remember log management. What about patch management? What about configuration management? What about baseline? Baselines and/or configuration management. What about continuous monitoring? Any and all of these things become important. We have to be thinking about them. The value of change control, the value of configuration management, these are underlying assumptions. These are, in effect, givens that we have to assume are going to be in the business. And if we don't find them there, we have to take steps immediately to figure out how to implement them. I deal with many, many customers. I deal with many businesses, not just in the United States, but globally on a regular basis. Almost without exception, it's hard to say 100%, but almost without exception, every one of my customers has an understanding of the things we've been talking about, knows the importance of them, identifies the fact that these are critical elements to success in terms of securing the organization. But like many of us, is not 100% aligned or are not 100% aligned with every one of those things and is not doing or are not doing any or all of them on a regular basis consistently. And this is where we find ourselves. This is one of the reasons why the continued skyrocketing growth in the need for security professionals seems to be unrestrained, even going into this year and beyond. We project for the next several, probably 5 to 10 years at least, that security professionals, in terms of the need for them in the organizations that we represent and manage and work for, is going to continue to grow because the complexity and the needs of the organization, vis-a-vis and with regards to, that's another cool word, by the way, vis-a-vis, it's very cool to say. It's also like really good to spell. You get the little año at the top there, right? Not the año, but the little, whatever the French equivalent of the año is, a little apostrophe or whatever it is. So with regards to that, with cloud, with virtualization, with the Internet of Things, with the idea of being able to have convergence and converged systems. You know, I was reading right before we started up again for finishing up the CISSP material and bringing you the new episodes we're doing now and are finishing up with. I was reading some stuff on the Internet of Things, just catching up on some stuff I hadn't been able to get to while we were filming and just continuing my thought process. I do a lot of work with cloud security, things of that nature. And I was actually writing an article that was going to be published probably the next couple of months for one of the magazines that I do some work for on occasion with regard to cloud security. And so I was just doing some research, and I was reading up on the Internet of Things and this idea of converged systems and all the things they represent. And, you know, one of the catchy bylines that people were using to represent the Internet of Things recently is the Internet of Insecure Things, right? Because reality is, you know, and this past year especially has shown that the reality is that while we still have made tremendous strides, there's a huge amount of work to do, and there's a huge amount of unsecured and uncontrolled infrastructure that's being connected to the cloud, either directly or indirectly. And this represents a significant concern, not just for individuals with their smart devices and their, God help me, I'll say it again, apps that I love, right? But all the other things that we do as well. I mean, you know, IP enabling and IP connecting up to the cloud, the toaster oven, the home thermostat, the air conditioning or HVAC systems in buildings, the monitoring systems for fire safety and for elevators and all that stuff. You know, a lot of that is great, very important, all kidding aside, and it's super critical to be able to do these things to ensure life safety and to be able to do the things we need to do. But the downside to that is that everybody else that has no business seeing that information is potentially exposed to it if we're not really smart about what we do. And it's the job of the CISSP to be smart. It's the job of the CISSP to consider and to act consider and to act in a considered way with regards to these kind of systems. It's easy to say, oh, yeah, let's just do that. Let's hook that up. It's not so easy to say, let's do that, but let's be risk adverse and let's be risk aware while we're doing those things. And what I often see is a rush to functionality, a rush to enablement of features, not a rush to risk management and not a rush to risk adversity, but rather a rush to risk awareness and awareness of risk. Yeah, we've got a risk, but God, I don't know what to do about it, so I'm just going to turn it on and hope nobody bothers me. I mean, that's really not going to be a very good solution. We've talked a lot about why over our time together through many episodes. You know, but and it's many different things. It's not one thing, but you can look for numerous examples in any given year across any given timeline of why just turning something on without fully understanding the impact of what that system represents is a significantly bad idea. I've talked about several of them over episodes with you. The ability to be able to hook up cabin-based avionics on a plane to the internet in-flight wireless system and why that's a really bad idea. Thankfully, that's not being done anymore. But when it was being done, why that was such a horrendously bad idea and why nobody thought it was a bad idea is the subject of many ongoing conversations, right? Why hooking up SCADA and ICS systems to the internet can be a tremendous value add for businesses that have to remotely manage, but why doing that without updating security protocols and configuration settings to safeguard the information on those networks is a very bad idea. And there's just a laundry list of these examples, right? So thinking about these things, understanding why we do what we do, and trying to be smarter, trying to be better about it, is definitely not only a good New Year's resolution for everybody, but is generically a good idea for anybody that's connected to system security at any level for any reason. End users should be the first people, not the last, that challenge assumptions and say, why am I doing something that seems to not make sense? If we can get our end users to give us that kind of feedback as security professionals, think about what a different world it would be. Mm-hmm. If instead of viewing users, right, and all kidding aside, because we often joke, and I joke about it as much as anybody else does, and Mike loves it when I make those jokes, says to me every time we go off the air, hey, make another user joke. They're so funny, right? Do it again. But all kidding aside, if we could turn the mindset of the security professional away from, oh my God, users, what a pain they are, right? The bane of our existence, the IT10 jokes, right? Or IT10T jokes, right? Get rid of that persona and that thought process of the end user being the bane of our existence as IT security professionals and generically as IT professionals and turn them into an early warning system through security awareness training and through the adoption of best practices and through understanding of root cause analysis and why we do things, the reasons why and the way we do them. If we can get them to be better educated, think about the fact that you now, in theory, in a 1,000-user network, would have 1,000 pairs of eyes, ears, and hands acting as early warning sensors for you if you could achieve what I'm talking about. Even if you got a tenth of the way there, you got 100 of those people to act smarter, to be a little bit more engaged, to tell you when something looks like it is not behaving and doing the things it should do, you've got 100 early warning systems that you couldn't buy if you spent $1 million in order to deploy, because they are going to be able to intuitively tell you when something doesn't look right, even though it may on the surface appear right. And I'm not suggesting that our goal as CISSPs needs to be to go out and change the world and get users to become this kind of a thought process and instantiate in their minds to become our early warning net. What I'm simply pointing out to you is there's more than one way to approach risk management. And sometimes it takes money, sometimes it takes resources, sometimes it takes time, system architecture, redesign, all the things we've been talking about. Sometimes it could be as simple as simply saying to somebody, hey, if this happens, just make sure you let me know as soon as possible. That doesn't take anything other than you stopping and spending 10 minutes with that user and educating them as to why it's important to tell you or to whatever telling you equals, send an email, open up a ticket in the help desk, whatever it is, to ask them to be proactive. Imagine how much more impactful your security systems would be and your risk management would be if you're able to do those things. And these are the kind of things that we talk about, right? Testing and verification, patch management, all this stuff's good. But all this relies on us configuring a bunch of stuff, automating a bunch of stuff, and then hoping that our configuration and automation is done in the right way so that it picks up the things that are aberrant, that are not supposed to be there. What if we got it wrong? What if all the stuff we configured is not the stuff that's going to go wrong? Our systems are going to work 100% spot on. They're going to be flawless, but they're going to execute in the wrong place, looking for the wrong things, examining the wrong events, and therefore tell us everything is fine. The system isn't broken. The configuration is what is a problem. You implemented it poorly, right? And as a result of that, system's going to work just fine, but you're never going to know about the risk. It's just not going to be reported. But if you had users that were paying attention, that said, you know, even though Adam said everything should look okay, I get the feeling this isn't right. I should probably say something to somebody. If somebody just did that, imagine how much more secure a system could be. And it's a combination of these things that we have to take on and think about when we think about these kind of solutions. It's not just, in other words, the hardwired systems. It's not just, in other words, the ability to be able to anticipate, guess, and configure accordingly. It's much more than that, because it's the intuitive nature of the things we see that we haven't anticipated, but that somebody understands is not correct, that can also lead us to understanding and uncovering risk, threat, vulnerability, and as a result of that, potentially mitigating a concern before it gets out of hand. And we have to have a combination of both. So things like code signing are very important. We've talked about the value of digitally signing code and the reasons why this is critical. But human awareness, right, and human intelligence also plays a significant role here. So just think about that and be aware of these kind of things. I'm not suggesting, again, you go out, stop everything you're doing, stop buying and investing in that technology, stop implementing automation, and put a bunch of people out there with their eyes glued to a, you know, monitor waiting for something to happen. Because that's going to be just as ineffective as if you did what we just discussed without the human component or element. The goal is to try to marry the two together, right? Because not every system is going to catch everything, and not every human user is going to see everything. And the more eyes, the more ears, the more systems we have monitoring, ultimately the better we're going to be. We also have to keep in mind and consider the concerns around regression testing and system integration, right? Systems that are designed to work a certain way, as we update and change them over time, may change the underlying assumptions of that architecture. And if we're not testing the changes, think about patch management as a good example of this. If we're not patch managing, and part of patch management is regression testing to validate that that patch will not break anything already in place in the system. If we're not doing that, we're going to have a concern as well. So regression testing becomes very important. We have to think about the kind of testing we do in general. We should have a general library of tests that we always use and roll out and manage change through. Regression testing is one of them. Acceptance testing typically would be another that we want to make sure that we are thinking about and doing. This is a formal test that's used to go through and actually validate a system and ultimately decide that the system as delivered, as configured, as operated will be good, and then to document that formal acceptance at the end of the testing cycle. So want to make sure we're thinking about that, want to make sure we are concerned about these things. Software assurance is also very important. How do we go through the thought process around assuring that software is going to be secure, is going to be well-built, is going to be aligned with the functional requirements that we have stipulated and specified? Well, clearly, we've talked about this already, the use of an SDLC is going to help us to drive through that, but software assurance is a byproduct of that. It is an outcome, in other words, right? And the idea is that if we don't implement security through the SDLC, we're not going to have software assurance out the back end. We can use an SDLC, a software development lifecycle, in order to develop software. But if we're not using security as a component that is an add-on, a bolt-on to the SDLC, and focusing on security at every phase, we're not necessarily going to have software that we can assure ourselves and those that are using it will be secure. We may, in other words, create a software product that has functionality, but from a security standpoint, it may or may not be secure. And so just because we use an SDLC doesn't mean we equal security and assurance. We have to use security as part of that SDLC, and we often go the extra mile and say it's not just the SDLC, it's the secure SDLC that we really have to focus on to create assurance. We want to make sure we're thinking about that and that we're aware of that as well. And, you know, there are phases associated with software assurance. Planning, contracting, monitoring and acceptance, and follow-on are traditionally the four phases we associate with software assurance. And in every one of these phases, we have to worry about security, have to worry about validation of assumptions, have to worry about functionality, all the things we talk about in the SDLC and the software development lifecycle. But security being added early and often into those phases are going to help us to align with and ultimately achieve the end results we want through a software assurance phase, or rather a software assurance plan or thought process, phase by phase, area by area, which is ultimately we want software that is secure, that's validated, that has been tested, and that ultimately is going to operate securely and not expose confidentiality, integrity, or availability concerns in the system, and is then going to be able to be change managed and configuration managed ultimately through its life cycle. So we want to make sure we're focusing on all these things as well, really making sure we understand the risks associated with a lack of a security thought process with regards to the SDLC and the negative outcomes that can ensure. And I will underscore that word, that they can ensure if we don't apply security thoughtfully and formally at every stage of the SDLC, you know, as we've already talked about.
All right, Adam, another great episode there, you know, a look at that software development security and really being able to test the effectiveness of the security that we've tried to impart into that software. So thank you for that, Adam. We appreciate that. Hope you guys out there in TV land enjoyed watching. Remember, if you want to attend one of Adam's classes live, shoot us an email here at cadam@itpro.tv. Signing off, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm Adam Gordon.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care, everybody.